The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled Allegory and Rhetoric.
Brought up this proposition that the Pearl of Great Price restores lost teachings of the gospel, the lack of which had caused everybody to stumble. Is it as hot as, is this a Turkish bath in here or something? I can't see anybody. It's a hammam. Now, as a result, you see, of these lost parts, we're told that there's great disagreement as to what the scriptures meant, and it's kept the world in turmoil for centuries. After the mid-19th century, an issue largely ignored by laymen, before them, but it always come up among the doctors of the schools, it became the main object of controversy. So we have these two, the doctrinal differences and the scientific ones. The question now is whether the scriptures have any value at all. First was how we're to interpret them. Now, do they have any value at all when we're dealing with the real facts of life? Beside moral value, of course, they're moral and that sort of thing. The teachings would have to be restored on a basis of scientific reality or dropped entirely. This is what they said they interpreted. From the second century on, the schoolmen had accommodated their teachings to the teachings of the schools. It was one long undignified retreat. Every time the schoolmen, that is the latest science of the time, changed their opinion, the theologians would change theirs to match it. It's been going on ever since then. And so the teachings of the schools completely dominated by rhetoric. There were the schools of rhetoric. Success schools, business schools, what they all turned out to be. That's another story, but it's a very important one. Now, the first casualty of this loss, of course, was literalism. Gibbon writes in The Decline and Fall, this is the situation. The most learned of the fathers, by a very singular condescension, have imprudently admitted the sophistry of the Gnostics, acknowledging that the literal sense is repugnant for every principle of faith as well as reason. You must never take anything literal in the Bible, you see. They deem themselves secure and invulnerable behind the ample veil of allegory. Allegory, say a thing one way, you mean it another way. Allegory is different meanings. Allegoria is how you think it. Allegory is important. I mean, if I can say, well, they say the classic example, of course, when the scripture speaks of God coming or going, it can't possibly mean that. It's just a sense. It's be given another interpretation, or that he has eyes. It just means that there's an awareness there. But he can't be like us in any sense. And when it says we're in his image, well, that's allegorically we're in his image. The the very first of the fathers that started this, men like Origen, Irenaeus, their favorite term was the visible image of the invisible God. He is in the image of man, but he is invisible. And as the visible image, well, of course, an image is something that you can see. But you can't see, it's an invisible image, is what God is, you see. It's like saying it's soundless music or odorless perfume. It's the real thing. I mean, it's a contradiction of terms, an invisible image. Well, behind the veil of allegory, and that's where they've lived ever since. Joseph Smith comes along and gives us a very different story, doesn't he? I really saw the angel. He gives us a clinical account, how he looked, where he stood, and so forth, just like the first chapter of Luke. Well, now, we were going to, only there was a limit here. Allegory could not explain what we've mentioned before, going to say what they are now, and the terrible questions. And we go to the first volume of the Patrologia for that. The terrible questions, because what made them terrible was the insistence on a literal answer. You have to give me a straight literal answer to this. I won't take, allegory could answer anything you wanted to. Put in any kind of answer, well, allegory, it's what I say it means. But we started up with the story of Clement in Rome, and he was just when he was a young fellow. Clement of Rome, the first and oldest writer after the New Testament. We mentioned before there's this great collection of Patrologia. We have them all over, along with the Oriental Patrologia and others. It grows; it's over 1,000 volumes. All the writings of the early church in chronological order, and number one is our friend Clement, and he's going to be very important here. He tells us his story, and we mentioned that it was a recognitio. It's a very common thing. We have this today. It reflects the condition of the world. It began with the New Comedy, 3rd century, and second centuries B.C., with Menander and picked up by the Romans, and we made a big thing of it, Clovis and Terence. And it was a story of families that had been broken up, and then they recognized, because recognition is a great tearjerker, as you know. The breaking up is interesting, how kids were constantly being kidnapped, little children in crowds at festivals. The new comedy, as you know, was picked up by Shakespeare. That's the comedy of errors. It's just taken it's simply taken from Plautus. It's the two twins separated, you see, at different times. Shipwreck was a common one because there were lots of merchants in it, lots of traveling. Remember the recognition by the locket. This all through the Middle Ages, always these tokens of recognition. The theme, the standard theme of the Blood and Thunder operas and so forth, a spoof by Gilbert and Sullivan, like a big thing of recognizing these things, you know, the older one, yes, was, Your Master was the other. The older one was Jack, Your Master was the other, like that, where the babies got mixed up at birth, and as a result, you see, the captain should have been Jack Tar, and Jack Tar should have been the captain, but they were twins, and the nurse got them mixed up. They were separated, and you recognize them by the letter, or the token, or the wrappings, or things like that. This picture of a restless world, we talked about theatromania, they were always having these big shows, big markets, and so forth, and children were always getting swiped, just as people were always getting assassinated. I mentioned the last time from Varro's Re Rustica. A child in a crowd might very easily disappear, and it happened all the time. They were sold as slaves or in the thriving international sex business. It was very much like today, and it got worse and worse, and the whole thing collapsed, finally. But this is a recognition of a family that was broken up, and the Rei they found themselves together, and we have stories of this in our church history, was they all sooner or later joined the church, and that brought them all together. They never would have found each other if they hadn't independently joined the church. So he starts out, though, telling his story, and it's a very important one, because this tells us what the terrible questions are that only our Pearl of Great Price can answer here. And he starts out, as he does, I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents, he starts out, ego clemens in urbe Roman natus, I, Clement, born in the city of Rome, from my earliest age was a studious child, and constantly concerned with certain questions, and salucitudinis et moriores apera from my boyhood, I could not break myself away from thinking about these things. It's quite common, tests really recently taken, you know. Questionnaires show that the part of the population that worries most about nuclear war is small children. 6, 7, 8 years old, they worry all the time about it, which surprised the experts. He says, well, he was always worried about certain things, and the big things. Incertum sana und initium sum serit. He says, I don't know exactly where I started doing that or where the idea came from, but I worried about it all the time. Things like this, my mortal condition bothered me. And these were the questions that I had. First of all, the big one, doctrum sunt mihi aliqua vita post mortem, whether I would have any life after death at all. If you've answered that, you've answered an awful lot. And if you can't, then you're in the soup. You have nothing much to look forward to, and it becomes very discouraging. But this is the big question we find that nobody can escape from. You think you can, but you can't. We will refer to that later. And, well, that led to another question, a corollary of that. If I would like live at all after death, well, if I lived after death, would I remember? Would I be myself after death? Would I turn into some other creature? Well, then there's a transmigration. What's the point of living after death if you cease to be yourself and start to be somebody else? That is part of many religions, as you know, and that wouldn't satisfy him at all. So he starts out, the Egyptians would agree with, well, we get some Egyptian here anyway. So whether there was any life for me at all after death, and secondly, could I possibly, after I left, would I be the same person? Nulla prorsus plainly and simply says, vita huius erit post obitum recordatio, would I have any memory of this life after, or would I turn into another person entirely? And the third one was B, or would I forget absolutely everything? Would I simply be going into complete oblivion? Shakespeare's last stage of all, isn't it? Is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans eyes, sans teeth, sans taste, sans everything. The last of the seven ages of man, his second childhood, and mere oblivion. Well, the next step from that is into nothing at all, you see. Shakespeare dwells morbidly on that. But this worries him. But along with this, yes, oblivion and silence, look forward to. Or would I probably remember something of this life? Well, along with this are the conditions which a continued existence, which continued existence implies and requires. Namely, you have to have a physical substrate in cosmology. So the next question he asks is the normal one. Quando factisit mundus? When was the earth created? Was it created? And what existed before that? Was there anything before the earth? Notice he goes into questions of cosmology from questions that seem to be theology. But if you're going to live hereafter, this is literalism. It has to be literal, first of all. He's not going to settle for, oh, he's going to tell us the doctors of the church could give him beautiful allegories, but that didn't mean a thing. As the first apologist of the church says, you use these things to us Christians, they mean nothing. A thing is either what you say it is or it isn't. Well, anyway, he says, or after it was made, quid erat, what was it? Very simple, or would it live forever? Or would it pass away? And what was the world and what was there before it? And if that's being the case, well, if it must pass away too, if it was created out of nothing, when would that be? Could it exist further? Or is it possible that quod nunc sentirum mortalium non potest mens, or simply something completely beyond our thought and we just have to drop it and not even think about it? Said, I would like to have forgotten it, but you can't forget about it. As A. E. Housman says, but men betimes are sober. They think by fits and starts, and when they think, they fasten their hands upon their hearts. If you didn't have to think about it, that'd be fine, but you can't escape from it is the trouble. When you think about it, it's too bad. Well, ceaseless, he says. He worried about this. He started to lose weight. He got sick just for brooding about it, about the big one. Because what dogged me all the time was this, quiescere non sinerit immortalitatis cupido. My passion, my desire for immortality just wouldn't let me alone. It wouldn't let my mind be quiet, he says. And I was going around this way, and I went to the schools. His family was well-to-do, so he visited the schools of the philosophers, he said, to find an answer. I visited the philosopher's schools, and what did I hear there? Nothing but dogmatic associations and rebuttals, and nothing but a constant wrangling and display of wits. Certamina artis syllogismorum, always displaying their skill in syllogisms, binding words together. If A equals B, B equals C, therefore God is at the end of a chain of syllogism. And the main purpose was to show off, he says. Everyone's showing his versatility, and that was what they got paid for, and that's what they did. But they never really came to grips with the subject. Quod sententiae ac definitione rerum, they were always giving opinions and definitions, but what about the things themselves? He said they had nothing to do with that. Pro natura sui ac veritate causorum, sed pro ingenuis defendentium. It wasn't to get into the real nature of things, but simply to show the cleverness of the defenders, the ingenious, the ingenuity of the people who made the arguments. School didn't please him at all, because were they really asking those questions? We're not supposed to ask that. That's really the only question we ask. If we have any science and art and literature, all are trying to get a picture of the world, and you can only get that. Well, we'll see that later. But what does he do now? Then he started to worry about hell. And this is a Roman hell, the old Roman hell. It's the pagan hell. Though, incidentally, he lives at the time of Christ, because he's living in the time of the Emperor Tiberius. This is the golden age of Rome, very prosperous. And here he is, can have anything he wants to do, but he's just worried sick. And everybody was worried sick. They started importing all sorts of religions, because the state religion didn't satisfy people very much. But what about going to hell? I heard about that. I heard these stories, you know, about Periphlegethon, the fiery flood, and Tartarus, and Sisyphus and Tityus being tormented there, and Tantalus. You always know the story of Tantalus and so forth. And this was it. Any way you looked at it was scary in Shakespeare's play Measure for Measure, which they're putting on here this spring. It's going to begin pretty soon, Measure for Measure. when Claudio doesn't want to be executed, he expresses his objections to his sister, and he says, "Aye, but to die and go we know not where, to lie in cold obstruction and to rot, that's not a thing to look forward to, you see. This sensitive warm motion to become a needed thing." And then he goes on, "Or here, oh, and the delighted spirit to bathe in fiery flames, or to reside in rock-ribbed, in thrilling regions of rock-ribbed ice." See, there's Dante. The hell is ice there. It's not hot. Or, and of course, the conventional Roman hell was fire. Or thick ribbed ice, to be imprisoned in the viewless winds and blown with restless violence round about the pendant world. This is the, remember, Francesca de Rimini, that was their punishment. Of course, that Satan is the prince of the air. His great curse, according to very early tradition, is that he can't put his foot anywhere. He has no solid ground. He has no body. And this can be very annoying. It can give you vertigo. But around the pendant world, or to be worse than worst, he says, of those that lawless and uncertain thoughts imagine howling. Notice those. This is purgatory. See, he recognizes, Shakespeare recognized that it's lawless, it's not in the scripture, and it's uncertain, you can't be sure about purgatory, and it has people howling in purgatory. Remember Hamlet says, a ministering angel shall my sister, you churlish priest, he says, a ministering angel shall my sister be when thou liest howling. And so he says, 'tis too horrible, and then he concludes, the weariest and most loathed earthly life, or worldly life, he says, that age age ache and imprisonment, that age ache, what is it? The weariest and most loathed worldly life, that age ache something and imprisonment can lay on nature is a paradise to what we fear of death. The worst thing you can possibly think of is, so this is what scares the daylights out of everybody. And this is what he was worried about. What about answering these questions? You see that the philosophy won't touch it at all. And remember that shortly after this, Christian theology went completely over into philosophy. Completely, you couldn't be a bishop unless you were you had been trained in the rhetorical schools and knew all the tricks. Very, very soon became the rule that age ache. What else would it be beside age and ache and imprisonment? Well, anyway, he goes on here. And he says these worried him. I knew they were just stories, fairy stories, but there was just a chance. If they weren't true, then couldn't I be free to go out and have some fun, he says. Why behave in that case? Remember in the Book of Mormon, when Korihor starts preaching, it says, notice, he based his whole doctrine on this one thesis, that when the man dies, that is the end thereof. Therefore, they lifted up their heads and rejoiced in their wickedness. There was nothing to restrain them. It was just a moral teaching anyway. But when the man dies, that is the end thereof, and all of Korihor's mischief evolves from that. Well, he doesn't want to misbehave. What should I do? He says, I said, well, I'll go to Egypt. He decided he'd go to Egypt. He had the money. He'd go to Egypt. And then he's make friends with a with the Herons and the prophets in the temples there, and go around and inquire, and they'd be perfectly willing for money, because they were very indigent in the temples at that time, willing to take up, and for money, pay them to invite some spirit from the other world, and then I'll know that there is something hereafter. That's right. That they can teach me something about the hereafter. I know the Egyptians are always talking about it, he says. And that will at least solve the one question I want to know, whether the spirit is immortal. And I don't mean just in the spirit, he says, sed aliquid audio et ex aliquid video. I wanted to see what I could hear, if they could let me hear something and see something, then I'd be sure. But merely to talk about it as philosophy wouldn't satisfy me. So he decides to go. Well, he had a good friend of his who was in the philosophy school, and he says, don't do that, whatever you do. It would be a very dangerous thing, the last thing in the world you could do. Because if nothing happens, then you will be desperate. And if you don't go, then there's always a possibility that there might be something. Just leave it at that, he says, and don't do it. Well, he goes on with the story, though. Now, he says at that time, there was news and rumor going around the city, very early, about a certain, the kingdom of it was being evangelized that the kingdom of God had appeared in Judea somewhere, and there was a prophet preaching there, and that he backed up his preaching some claims by most singular prodigies and wonders. And these rumors grew in the city. I didn't know what to make of them, paid no attention, till one day, passing along in the street, there was a street meeting. And there are Virquidam Adstans in Urbis Loco, Caliberibus, right at the most busy crossroads in the center of Rome. Here was this character proclaiming, preaching to all the people standing around, proclaiming the Son of God has now appeared in the region of Judea, promising eternal life to those who would listen to him, that he'd been sent from God the Father and so forth. And he goes on, and then he talks about, he says what he speaks about is the matters both temporal and eternal. And naturally, this is Clement, was very much interested. That was Barnabas. Barnabas had come on a mission to Rome. And there were some students from the university handing around. They started making fun of him because he spoke with a broken accent. He spoke with a Jewish accent. And they were wits. Some of them would ask him, they laughed at him and exercised some syllogisms. For example, why did God make a flea with eight legs when he made a huge elephant with only four legs to hold it up? Why would he make a little flea with eight legs? Now, wouldn't that be silly of God? And then they'd all roar and laugh, you see. And gave some others, and he said, well, now, I could answer you, and I'd like to argue with them, but I have been sent on a mission here, and I can only teach what I have come to teach, and I should not be distracted. You can listen to it, or you can leave it alone, but that's what I have to do. And they started yelling, and then somebody threw rocks, and there started to be a mob. And so Clement grabbed Barnabas by the hand, he says here, and dragged him into an alley nearby, and they ran and got away from the mob. They took him to home, and Barnabas was very much discouraged because he had had no success in Rome in his mission at all. And he was going back, he had to go back to a conference, which is being, the general conference, which is being held in Caesarea. And there he did go. But Clement says, I can't go with you now. I have some business affairs to settle. But as soon as I do, I'll take the next ship and I'll follow you. Caesarea, you say? All right, I'll go there. He had a fascinating description of what the conference was like there. It's not like the other literature. I mean, the typical church literature, miracle literature and things like that at all. Peter is a very real character. He takes a swim in the ocean every morning. He has a very good sense of humor. And Clement wants to see him more than all, through the crowd and so forth. And he finally gets a conversation with Peter, and he tells him some wonderful things. He answers the questions that he wanted him to know. And he started out. First he says, what about my father and mother? They haven't heard this. Will they all be damned? Because they've never had the chance. And he says, now you're asking me to tell you things, Peter says, that you will learn later on, but I'm not supposed to tell you about now. You'll understand what our work for the dead is like when we get to that part. And he satisfies his mind on all things. So these are the questions he asks, you see. And so we start out this one with the literalism. And I have arranged here, which I've never used before, a lot of, in chronological order, this argument. So we'll only need to touch it at a few points to show what this is. Namely, the things to watch are this, that the early church was very literal-minded. The doctors hated it and got rid of it. And then they had to restore a lot, but they restored it in a different department. They brought it back again after the manner of the schools. It's always been changing since. But the main thing was to keep it allegorical so that we would be safe, as Gibbon says, behind the broad veil of allegory. Now this Clement, no less, in this same thing, Peter, in one of the first things Peter says to him is this, we affirm there is absolutely nothing evil in matter, because this was the doctrine, you see. God had to be immaterial and have no contact with material at all. This was Neoplatonism, not Platonism. Plato's different. But Neoplatonism was that matter is bad and evil and spirit is everything that isn't matter. So the only definition that they ever gave of God was the asomaton, that which has no body. The bodiless one was God. He couldn't be conceived. That was all you could say about him, as Origen says. And you could see they had a legitimate reason for regarding material and the flesh as loathsome, because that's the way everybody was behaving in those days. It was a period of decline, and they took it for granted that if a person had, people had bodies, they would misbehave and do anything that felt good and so forth, and that's what they were doing. We have a rich literature on that, of course. And the idea was, of course, that anything material was absolutely defiling. It was vicious, and so you get to the Neoplatonists, and with the doctrine that even any contact with God himself, any contact with matter would defile God himself. Well, how could God have made the universe then? He made a physical world, after all. Oh, no. That was made by the eons, the 30 eons created that in a row of eons. See, so there are 30 steps between God and the final creator, and that was a mistake. See, that was Sophia. The final eon was Sophia. And she misbehaved, and being female, she wanted to rule things, and she went wild in space, and the Lord gave her no more support, and she had a terrible abortion and brought forth a lot of filthy matter, and from that the world was made. So God is not responsible for this world, not at all. He is pure unmatter. They're rabid on that particular subject. So that's why it's so revolutionary when Peter says, we affirm absolutely that there is nothing evil in matter, thus countering the favorite claim of the Neoplatonists and Gnostics. The earliest Christian apologist, Aristides, will not waste his time arguing about abstractions, he says. We Christians simply will not accept any allegorical explanations. That's all they use in the Middle Ages. Later on, everything. See, there are the four interpretations of things that Thomas Aquinas gives us and so forth, and that we get in Rhetoric. There are the seven tropes of Tychonius, the rhetorical devices used in the schools, which St. Augustine says are the keys to Christian preaching. We adopt those. We adopt the method of rhetoric preaching, using all sorts of tricks. Say, there are the seven means of saying something when you mean something else. And these become the principal tools of the Christian teacher, teaching according to St. Augustine, the greatest of all Christian teachers, both for Protestants and Catholics. And he used it, certainly. He was the great reader, and that's in his great work called De Doctrina Christiana, on the teaching of the Christian faith. But here, before him, Aristides said, we just will not accept allegorical explanations. They are simply myths and nothing else, as you make them up. But the next apologist to follow him was the famous Justin Martyr, the first person to join the church who was a real first-class philosopher from the outside. They were very proud to get him. He never laid aside his philosopher's robe that he acquired in the schools. He was Justin Martyr, and he is the first philosophical martyr. He's called a martyr for that reason. But he had grown up in the schools. He never doffed his philosopher's robe. And he turns the whole thing around. He insists that the Christians have as much right to allegory as the Greek myths do. We can use, we can have our myths just as much, and see what we would see the mischief that would be done then. We can have just as right to, much right to the myths as you do, he says. It's really the Greeks who taint their allegory, he says, with a touch of the physical. The Greeks imply that there might be something physical in their myths, where there's nothing physical in any of ours. So how he'd shifted from the days of Aristides. Well, let's put Justin Martyr in the book. 120 is his date, very early, you know. Justin Martyr. He gets that title, of course, being a martyr. Some influential teachers who followed wanted to have it both ways. Early Christians, Bossuet says, that God and the heavenly spirit world must be thought of as physical. That's interesting that Bossuet, the very stout Catholic defender of this position, says, nevertheless, the early Christians thought of God and the spirit world as physical, while he himself does not share the view. In Clement of Alexandria writes, which now later on, there was Clement of Alexandria, not much later on. He was in the end of the second century, and he became the big name, Clement of Alexandria. He says, the old teachings began to shrink to a purely intellectual content. Already, you see, at the end of the second century, quoting Bossuet still, in Clement of Alexandria, the old teachings began to shrink to a purely intellectual content until he spiritualizes the sacraments to the point of being incomprehensible, nothing but a mere game of words. Well, now that the most eminent Bossuet, the most eminent Catholic writer, says that's what it became. Did they ever get out of it? Did they ever get rid of it? No. This has become the rule ever since. Though Tatian, who's given us his versions, four versions of the gospel, informs us that it was the pagan philosophers who laughed at the Christian anthropomorphism. He says in his day, Tatian is another very early one, he says what the pagan philosophers laughed at in Christianity was its anthropomorphism, the idea that God should look like a body, showing that the Christians did teach that, the anthropomorphic God. And the schools of the philosophers laughed at it, so they turned around and joined the schools. Still, Tatian ends up on their side, and as does Minucius Felix. It comes a little later. Next to anthropomorphism, the first thing the intellectual and Gnostics denied was the physical resurrection. They could not tolerate that idea. We read in the newly found Bodmer Papyrus, number 10, a Coptic papyrus found in Egypt from the very early days of the church. It's supposed to be 3 Corinthians. This is Paul's third letter to the Corinthians. Some people think still it's genuine. But it's against these Gnostics, and you mentioned what the Gnostics were, the people that came out of the woodwork and so forth. The funny thing is that the clergymen and priests who know nothing at all see Gnosticism in Mormonism. They, well, that's just Gnosticism. The great sin of the Gnostics was to dematerialize everything. And this is what we find in the Bodmer Papyrus, for example. It said, it gives a number of follies, of false doctrines taught by the Gnostics. And the first one is that there is no physical resurrection. The second is that God created a physical world, and we can't have that, you see. Well, they just ruled out everything physical. And the early apologist Athenagoras objects. He said, life would be an utter waste without the resurrection. It's the resurrection which gives everything in human life its meaning. And the great Origen, who is more important, the greatest of all theologians, was Origen. He was born and raised and grew up on the campus of the University of Alexandria. And in those, he has a good Egyptian name, born of Horus, Origen, and 230 he flourishes, A.D. He grew up in the university, and he was such a dedicated student, a phenomenal person. And when he became a Christian, he took over the doctrines of the early church, but he couldn't agree with a lot of them. But he does give us what they are. And he tells us he can't agree with this, but this is what the brethren taught. This is what they used to teach in the church. And so he's a valuable source. And in his famous argument with Celsus, Count Celsus. Now, Celsus had written, way back in the year 80, had written a scathing attack on the church. And he gives him a reply. Years after, Origen gives a reply. But in the process of replying to Celsus, he has to tell the things that Celsus accused the Christians of teaching. So this is the best, his Contra Celsum is the best source we have of what the earliest Christians taught, next to the Bible itself and the Clementines. Then we get to Origen here. And he's honest enough to report, he says the early Christians believed, and because he was always giving away what the early Christians believed, he lost his chance to become a saint. He never became a saint, or a doctor of the church. So he's the most influential. He has enormous writings. Augustine is nothing but a paraphrase of Origen, after all. He lived earlier, see. He kept 7 stenographers, beautiful girls, incidentally, at work, taking dictation all day long. He answered all the questions in the book. He was enormously productive. Keeping the 7 beautiful stenographers working is something to be said in his favor. Though he himself, now this is to show why he's the one who says all you can think of God is that he has no body. That's all you can say. He can have no body, nothing physical about him at all. And he himself was so averse to it that he wouldn't eat anything. Somebody gave him an inheritance of some sort, and he'd spend a penny or two a day for a few grains of wheat. And then he would eat them and vomit them up, disgusted with his own physicalness. It was an anorexia, you see. People actually do get as crazy as that. Well, he was an anorectic, and he looked it, and was very skinny and cadaverous. But that's not what the early Christians believed. Also, he, as one brought up within the University of Alexandria, has concluded when there was they were running down Christians in Alexandria. His father didn't want him. He was 17 years old then. Didn't want him to get to go out, to leave the place, to leave the house. So he hid all his clothes, so he couldn't get away. And Origen was very modest, so that was a very effective work. But more than anything else, Origen will not allow holiness to anything corporeal. He says the resurrection can only be spiritual, a non-physical resurrection. There you are again. You see your asomaton somatis, your invisible image. Your unphysical resurrection. When God's voice spoke from the heavens, it was not a real voice, he says, since only the elect heard it. See, they're already he is allegorizing the great Origen. The doctrine that God and the Son go to and from the earth, he says, is quite offensive, but only if one takes it literally. Well, no doctrine is offensive if you don't take it literally. That's it. There's nothing wrong with saying thou shalt not commit adultery, or why not say you shall commit adultery? If you don't take it literally, though, well, you're all right then, you're safe. And this is what they're doing, deliteralizing everything. Now, We know as well as you do, he tells his pagan opponent, Celsus, that God does not move. So how could he go from place to place? In the parousia, that is the return of the Lord, God does not descend to the earth in a topical sense, but only pronetikos. Pronoetikos means in a mental sense. God descends to earth in a mental sense. All right, you think of him as being here and he's here. Well, this is the way he talks. Whoever desires the highest good, wrote Lactantius, who is the first of the Latin fathers. Lactantius comes first, and he is the best Latinist. He read for that. And he left the church, as so many of the earlier ones did. St. Augustine did too, you know, for 9 years. He wouldn't have, because he says, we don't have the old doctrine anymore. And Lactantius left the church and joined a pious group that tried to live the original order of Christianity. There were lots of people doing that in his time. It's only the sixth volume of the Patrologia, the Greek Patrologia, see. He says, whoever desires the highest good, let him desire to live without a body, for matter is evil. After noting that the scribes and Pharisees reject the Old Testament references to Christ because they would not accept his being born in a physical body. Now, this is St. Hilary, who lives up in Gaul and has great influence on the editing of the scripture. Hilary can still affirm that the physical resurrection of the righteous is a contradiction, that to rise with sinful bodies would be saved, to be saved into nothing, he would say. A physical resurrection is only for the wicked. They deserve it. This is what the great Hilary was teaching about the resurrection. It was just for the wicked. Only the wicked would be resurrected. Isn't that a promise? And Rufinus, who is very important, he translates all the earliest Greek writers in the 4th century into Latin so the Romans people, the Latin people could read them. We owe him, well, a lot of Clementine recognition, Clement of Rome, has come to us in writings that he has given us. The Greek part's been lost in some of them, not all of them. But he says, after the resurrection, all will be spirit, no bodies. Well, what's the point of having a resurrection? Here's another one of those flat contradictions, you see. Eusebius goes all the way. Any appearance of God must necessarily be an intellectual and a spiritual one, he says. Bluntly, Christ did not die. Now, this is Eusebius, the father of church history, who's the greatest source we have for church history. He was a personal friend of the Emperor Constantine. He tells us about the Council of Nicaea, and he was there. And this is not Hilary, it's... What was I talking about? Yes, the Eusebius, the father of church history, I think. There are other Eusebius, but this is the one. You can remember it by 325, the year of... It's awfully warm in here, isn't it? Can't think. Will everybody go to sleep and make it unanimous? I know a few people are doing it. then it doesn't bother me if I stumble around here, because then nobody's bothered. Neither am I. But I think these references are interesting. I arrange them in chronological order. This is the progress of the church, but it starts very early. Can you imagine Eusebius of Caesarea saying, bluntly, Christ did not die. He did not suffer the death of a common criminal. He says, prophets, apostles, and high priests are still in the church, but we see them all with the pure eye of our minds. Notice that we don't need literal prophets, we don't need literal apostles, we don't need high priests. No, we see them in our minds, and that's adequate. That's better than the other kind. They use that argument a great deal. He mocks one Marcellus for teaching that God has a body like a man, and his foolish teaching that Christ made human flesh immortal through the power of the resurrection. These are all quotations from Eusebius. He applauds the nobility and good taste of the Greeks and Romans, the old pagans, for interpreting their own deities allegorically. As we Christians should take a lesson from them and interpret our gods the way they do. They knew that the Greeks and Romans didn't take their nightlife of the gods seriously. Those are inventions of the poets, very largely. But this became the main weapon of the church. You see, your idolatry, your plurality of God, and they never believed in that. But they had to have something to make it appear that they had departed from the old ways and that they were more righteous and more severe and spiritual and so forth. We don't believe in all those idols and all those immoral gods. Well, I say the ancients didn't either. Their gods were something very different in the mysteries, in the ordinances, in the various celebrations. Now we have great literature on them. We didn't have it before. But we've been going on the poets. And so he says, it's unholy to say that matter is unbegotten or was only organized at the creation. Notice what they were preaching. That matter was not created and was only organized at the creation. It wasn't created out of nothing. It was organized at the creation, of course, which is what you teach. But he says that's what the early church thought, but it's unholy to say it. The real human is an intellectual, bodiless, immaterial, rational being, and as such, only is he in the image of God. And then he reveals himself in the seventh book of the history. He says it's the simple, old-fashioned Christians who believe in the old literalism. We're much too intellectual for them. We'll leave that all behind. We don't need that anymore. What marks the fourth century, as Alfieri puts it, is the victory, quote, the victory of abstract ways of thinking, the universal triumph of theory, which knows no half measures. The Gnostic idea of the body as a prison is entirely at home with the doctors of the church. They love it, because matter is vile. Now, there was a very righteous old guy, and he tried to live out in his followers. They got quite close to the early church, and they suffered a lot of persecution for it. Noted for their old-fashioned ways, he left the main church because of the immorality of the clergy and stuck to a literal interpretation of the scriptures. Now, even us, says Epiphanius, to believe that we actually are in God's image, and that actually refers to Adam's body. Three exclamation points with Epiphanius puts in there. Epiphanius lifted over 80 of these heresies in the third century that carried over. He's writing in the fourth century. But everybody had his own doctrine, was preaching his own way, but the thing to do is leave out anything literal, anything physical, anything material, anything that smacks of Mormonism. St. Augustine, our friend, goes all the way. Christ is with us if we believe. His dwelling in you is more than real. In fact, if he were outside you, before your eyes. It's more real to have Jesus in here than to have him out there and so forth. When everything dissolved into abstractions, it left an uncomfortable feeling behind. The generation that rids itself once for all of the old literalizers of which Jerome speaks, craved. Jerome lived in Jerusalem in Bethlehem, actually, a monastery there for 15 years, and knew the Christians at Jerusalem, and there were old groups that still hung on, and he called them the old-fashioned Christians, the literalizers, he called it. They would take you up to the top of the Mount of Olives and show you a plot that the church owned, where they said the temple was going to be built when Christ came again. And this was the sort of thing they taught, and of course Jerome was shot. We're a physical temple, a physical return. We don't have anything like that. Whom Jerome speak of crave no other, the presence of physical objects to tie them to the reality of the scriptures. Well, but that's in the fourth century in his day, everybody started making pilgrimage because they wanted contact with something that had been physical. They went to the temple, but Jerome says, don't go to the site of the temple in Jerusalem. He says, does not the sepulcher of the Lord appear more venerable to you? In the resurrection, you have heard that all things will be without bodies. This is from the 11th volume of the Patrologia. There is a passage that says this. This is what we'll do when we're resurrected. Of course, we must be resurrected physically because the scripture says we will. So you will rise up with your body. But then as soon as it's completely incorporated and put together, then it will start to melt and dissolve and presently go away, so we won't be bothered with it anymore. So that accounts for the resurrection and makes it spiritual at the same time. He says, all things will be without bodies, for they will have no need of them, and all matter will return to the nihilum from which it was once made, to the nothing from which it was once made. All matter came out of nothing originally, and with the resurrection, will all be restored, and then it will return to nothing. Leave not a rack behind, as the Bard says. The good old Jerome. Well, then, after him, he must admit, though, he says here, the old Christians, as well as Tertullian, Victorinus, Lactantius, the earlier fathers, they all believed that the old Christians, what the old Christians believed, that the saints would reign with the Lord after the resurrection in the flesh. Yet he approves of pilgrim ladies who piously lick the place where the Lord lay in the Holy Sepulchre as they groan and sob. And also, see, in the fourth century, everyone started making pilgrimages to Palestine. And the church tried to stop them. Do you know there is not a single writing of the Catholic or Protestant church that encourages or recommends pilgrimages? You don't do it because it's an act, pilgrimages to the Holy Land. It's an act of no faith. I mean, if you really think that these things had been taken care of and the church was established now, the institution that makes saved, you wouldn't have to go back there to look for some tangible contact. That argues a lack of faith in our institution. And they fought it all the time, but the pilgrims started going, and they went, and they went, and they went, and they would go up to the top of the Mount of Olives, the main thing, and they would look up to heaven, the place where the Lord would come back again, and they would weep, and because that's where the Lord was last seen. They wanted a physical contact with what was there. And so he talks about the Holy Sepulchre is better. Go to the Holy Sepulchre instead. don't go to the place where the Lord left. And also paid a devout visit to the place. Incidentally, the same woman, this is Lady Sylvia, Lady Itheria, who in the 4th century, a very rich Gallic woman, who was written a marvelous account. She went on foot all over these places way back in the 4th century. Long flowing black robe and a terrific personality. She scared everybody to death, but she got to all these holy places. But at the same time, she visited the place where Andromeda was chained to the rock and Perseus rescued her. That was just as real. That, I guess it didn't belong to the gospel. As long as you were there, you might as well see the place, near Tyre, of course. And she also visited the cell of Sarah and saw the cradle of Isaac and things like that. And what goes on at the tomb of the saints, she said, such a howling and yelling and lamentation you can't imagine. It's just dimming, just like you have some festivals in India. People yelled their heads off and carried on and ranted. What strange pilgrimages. No wonder they shouldn't go. Why should we not honor relics, he asked, in view of the Psalms? Why should dead bones be considered pollution, since Elijah read? It's funny, they turned to physical bones because they wouldn't accept the physical. They wouldn't accept the literalness of the gospel. Then they turn, they go full blast for relics. They must be tangible things. There must be a cradle. There must be a house. They must, especially, there must be bones and so forth. Why should they be considered pollution? Jerome says, Elijah raised a dead body, but it wasn't a dead body anymore after he did that. Well, anyway, these go on and on. St. Basil, annoyed by the physical component of Christ, too physical to be the highest, he says, I believe the resurrection be the transition from his physical gnosis to his incorporeal theoria. Now, there's an Aristotelian expression. Theory is pure contemplation, just mind and nothing else. See, a theory, looking at. This is what St. Basil, who is one of the three great Cappadocians and one of the four doctors of the church, one of the four Greek doctors of the church, there are only eight doctors and he's one of them. He says, I believe the resurrection, and these people are the eight men, this is one of the big four, yeah, the Greek four, that laid the foundations of Christian doctrine, and I believe the resurrection to be the transition from this physical gnosis to incorporeal theoria. No body, nothing but just mind, and so forth. Angels do not have tongue or bow the knee, says Severus. Away with the thought. They're figures of speech. Christ ate and drank after the resurrection only to show that he, this is an amazing argument of Basil's, he ate and drank to show that he was not a fantasy, that he was physical. Well, that's a strange saying. Wine and food will partake of it with him, are his teachings. The wine and food really represented his teachings. He didn't really eat, but he had to represent that he wasn't a fantasy, so he ate to show that he was physical, but what he really ate was his teachings. This is the way we argue. Well, we don't want to stay on this forever, but you notice it is a formidable defect here, which only the pearl of great price can fill this gap for the present time, and we'll get on to particular things here. But this background, we've never referred to this before, but I think it's important because we don't realize that. And in the controversies that are raging today, they talk about the crazy Mormons being Gnostics and all this, God makers and so forth. That's exactly the way they talked about the early Christians. But you can't blame them. It was the doctors of the church who talked that way, and they are the ones to whom the Christian world is dedicated. They're the ones. I mean, John Knox and Luther, they quote these authors, these fathers, as the authorities just as often as they quote the Bible. They prove everything by these fathers, but none of the first and second century, all after the fourth century.